Zaytuna Institute Knowledge Resources present Redefining Muslim Families in the Modern Times with Imam Zaid Shakir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala Sayyidil Mursaleen wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallim tasliman kathira. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah. We thank Allah Ta'ala for the organizers and for all of the brothers and sisters who took the time to come here. May Allah reward you, and we pray that it's a source of mutual benefit for us. The title of this program, and I took my talk from this, Redefining Muslim Families in the Modern Time. So to provide a context to begin talking about this subject, I think it's important for us to realize that there is a traditional view of the family. And without going into definitions, that view revolves around the idea that the family, amongst other things, I'm looking at it from one aspect, is a tremendous, and in the view of many sociologists, and in terms of this socializing role, traditionally it performed three very important functions and other functions that are less important. One is reproducing cultural norms. So cultural norms such as language are reproduced in the family. Dress, for example, in traditional societies, why do members of one society all dress the same generally? This is our ethnic dress. So all of the Kurds dressed one way. All of the Arabs dressed one. All of the Yemenis, the Hadhramis, dressed one way. The people of the South Asia dressed a particular way. And there were local and regional variations of those dresses, dress codes, if you will. Norms of cuisine. Why do we have Iranian cuisine and Turkish cuisine and Malaysian cuisine? Because we have Iranian, Turkish, and Malaysian families, traditionally. Social space. Why do different people have different views of appropriate social spaces? So the Anglo-Saxon, if you're talking, you should be about this far away from here to be viewed as appropriate. Whereas the South American, Latin American, from Indian cultures, you might be this close. So, and there's a cultural conflict. So if you're from Venezuela, and Bob is from England or America, and you say, you know, Bob, how are you doing today? Bob might be very repulsed by that. You know, Julio, you know, please. No, we just met. I'm not like that. So these norms are passed on and reproduced in the context of the family. So Julio developed these spatial relationships and appropriateness first and foremost in his family. And these various cuisines, the various dresses traditionally. The second thing, reproducing ethical norms. A child learns that lying is not appropriate, fornication is not appropriate, cursing and using foul language is not appropriate, or the opposite, because ethics aren't always what we would perceive as being positive. So you can have a bad ethic, you can have a corrupt moral, for better or worse. The most important socializing agent is the family. Traditionally, this was the case. And thirdly, norms of character. What constitutes a positive work ethic? What's the most important factor in determining how are his or her parents? Do they watch around, lie around all day eating junk food? Well, traditionally, that wouldn't be relevant, junk food. But how do they approach work? Is it always something they expect an immediate return for, or do they do it happily because they realize that working hard is a means in and of itself towards a greater end, and not always a means to obtain some material compensation. Courage. How do the parents respond to situations that either call for courage or will be defined in terms of how those situations are resolved by manifesting courage or manifesting cowardice? This has a tremendous impact on the child. Patience. We can read a book about patience, the virtue of patience. We can read the Arba'in, the Ihya, or the Madarij al-Salikin, any book on the virtue of patience. But if we're not around people, starting in our family, who are patient, it's going to be a struggle for us. But if our parents, from the time we were, before the time we were even conscious, manifested patience in their dealing with each other, the child will never have to read a book that for a marriage to work, the couple have to be very patient in dealing with each other. You wouldn't have to tell a child that who's grown up in a family where the mother and father were very, very patient in dealing with each other. Unless the child is a sociopath, the child will assimilate that character in the context of being in that environment. So traditionally, the family perform those functions, those socializing functions. Now, in the modern situation, that's broken down by and large. The modern family is really more than anything else. So there are a lot of things that go into the modern family. At the danger of being Marxist in my approach, a lot of it is due to the Industrial Revolution. And we'll mention, again, just two things or two aspects of or two consequences of the Industrial Revolution as it relates to family. One, the Industrial Revolution, and this undermined the socializing role of the traditional family. One, it took work out of the home, or took the woman's work out of the home. And really the industry that characterizes the Industrial Revolution more than anything else. What industry epitomizes the Industrial Revolution? If we say Industrial Revolution, the rise of modern industry, what's the first industry that comes to mind? Think of Manchester, England. Hint, clue. Huh? Textiles, the textile industry. And the textile industry was instrumental in what? Taking clothes, the making of clothes, the manufacture of clothing from the home and out of the hands of the woman primarily, and putting it into factories. So when as a result of the Industrial Revolution, work left the home, it was primarily the woman's work initially. So the woman simply followed her work out of the home. So the Industrial Revolution took the women out of the home. The woman went from the spinning wheel in the house where she made her family's clothing, and from the sewing machine or its early modern predecessors, to the workbench in the factory. So this is the first consequence. The second consequence is, as industrialization took root in the initially industrializing societies, you had an increasingly specified division of labor. And this has gone on and on and continues to our day until the division of labor in terms of how a modern product, especially one more complex like an automobile, is manufactured. A horse and buggy or buggy, a horse cart, could be manufactured by one person in one location. And it didn't require any degree of education to make a horse buggy. One would be an apprentice to a buggy maker and could do it right there. You get the wood, you get the metal bands to make the wheels, if you use metal, hammer, nails, and you put the buggy together, and there's your means of transportation. An automobile, on the other hand, involves, and as society becomes more sophisticated and we put computers into automobiles and anti-lock braking into automobiles and all of these functions, involve functions, an automobile is made maybe in 100 different countries. One component's made here. Another's made there. Another's made in a third country. Another's made in a fourth. And they're manufactured in a fifth. The car is manufactured in a fifth company. And then the wherewithal that's involved in shipping it, all of those inputs involve myriad countries or locations. So as society advances and the division of labor becomes more complex, there's a need for specialized education. And the need for specialized education provided the context for the rise of the modern school. And again, the rise of the modern school had a tremendous influence on undermining the traditional role, socializing function of the family. And the weight of this, these two factors, work leaving the home and women generally leaving the home to pursue their work initially, and the rise of universal public education, which included the public education of women. And Sister Nabila was looking at some of the consequences, or speaking on some of the consequences of that, again, had a tremendous impact in terms of redefining the socializing impact of the school. And I'm going to read you a brief quote to just emphasize to you how that new context provided more impetus for people to exploit the situation, which led to even more dire consequences for the traditional family. So this is a quote that's referring back to something Durkheim, the father of sociology, Ibn Khaldun's the grandfather, so don't get upset. He said, so the author says, the school, according to Durkheim, constituted, and the quote begins here, a real group of which the child is naturally and necessarily a part. Consequently, we have through the school the means of training the child in a collective life different from home. Organization have not yet been able to arouse in him feelings that make him partially rebellious to common life. The upshot of this quote is that the schools provide a tremendous opportunity to undermine the authority of the family and to socialize the child into a set of publicly determined values that will undermine the privately determined values that the family provides. And what Sister Nabila was talking about essentially is reaffirming the primacy of the private, that the family as a private socializing agency should have preference over the public, which is embodied in the public school. So the breakdown due to this new situation, the modern family, the breakdown of the socializing role and function of the traditional family has two huge consequences. One is the breakdown of those three areas that we mentioned, and that is the breakdown of traditional cultural norms. So we mentioned the traditional family socializing or providing the context for the reproduction of cultural norms. We mentioned specifically language, dress, cuisine, and social space. So with the breakdown of traditional society, you see the disappearance of traditional dress. So this is illustrative of the breakdown of cultural norms. You see the breakdown, the disappearance of traditional cuisine. Now, in many places, you get hybrid cuisines, but you see this breaking down. And a generation or two removed from that traditional context, the person's Italian, but they can't make a good pasta. I can't think of Italian dishes. I'm getting excited. They're what?
Meatballs.
That's not Italian. That's American. Their lasagna is terrible. So out of desperation, they let Sara Lee or someone make the lasagna, which comes back to the specialized division of labor. So everything is reinforcing. breakdown of traditional ethics and standards and codes of ethics. So we mentioned lying, fornication, cursing. So you get the sexual revolution. So the ethic that says fornication is wrong no longer means anything in this new context, which produces a new set of ethical standards. We mentioned cursing. What's wrong with cursing? They're only words. These are only words. So that traditional context that says there are higher sources of authority that one should be responsive to no longer mean anything. So if I swear, there's no greater consequence. There's no metaphysical consequence. And we'll talk about that in a minute, inshallah. And then character and those things that embodied a traditional standard of lofty character. Again, those things, again, no longer mean anything. So what does it mean to be courageous? The only important thing is my ability to make money. And if I can do that without being courageous, courage doesn't mean anything. Or we mentioned in the context of character, work ethic. Working hard in and of itself has no real intrinsic value. The only value in working hard lies in my enhanced earning power. So if I can work hard and make more money, that's fine. But if I'm going to make less money, why should I work hard? There's no intrinsic value in working hard in and of itself as a manifestation of a lofty characteristic trait or a lofty character trait. So you see this one consequence of the breakdown of the traditional family in light of the ascendancy of the modern family. You see the breakdown of these three areas. Secondly, you see the rise of consumerism. This is intricately associated with the rise of the modern family. And there are many explanations for that. One explanation is that the context for authenticating oneself is now taken away. And one can only authenticate himself or herself through the assertion of individuality. And the assertion of individuality provides the impetus for consuming and for consumerism. In a traditional society, what was your style as a member of that individual member of that society? Your style was everyone else's style. I wear what everyone else wear. If I'm a man and I'm a Kurd, we mentioned the Kurds earlier, my style is the baggy pants, tight around the ankles, baggy in the middle, a wide, colorful waistband. That's my style. And every Kurdish male dresses like that, without exception. If I'm a Muslim female, my style is whatever. If I'm in Afghanistan, a burqa. That's my style. And I don't need to authenticate myself by having a unique style that the fashion industry is more than willing to accommodate and encourage. So with the breakdown of the traditional family, we find the rise of consumerism as everyone tries to define and assert their own identity, leading to the desire to have their own unique style. And this creates a very contradictory situation, because my style ultimately is defined by the mass. So if you're a woman right now, your style, and Muslim parents encounter it, you're babbling with your child. You say, why are you wearing that? Because I want to have my style. I don't want to wear a taqiyya. I want to wear my style. So what do? They go out and dress like everyone else. The girls have to have a little midriff showing, without exception. But that's her style. And the boys have to have the pants drooping off their rear end, like everybody else. But that's their style. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that contradiction, which we're going to touch on, inshallah. So without going into too much detail, these are the two major consequences of the breakdown of the traditional family. Now, in terms of redefining the family, and this really moves into postmodernism, because if the traditional family was undermined by and supplanted by the modern family, the redefinition is going to either affirm the modern are moving to the realm of the postmodern. And as some people will say, well, it's an affirmation of the traditional, but the response leads to some absurdities. And one characteristic of the postmodern condition is the ascension of absurd situations. So we're going to talk about that, inshallah. One reaction, one redefinition is the conservative redefinition. Now this reaction, you can see it most articulately mentioned in the writings of James Dobson. Probably no one of you, not many of you, have heard of James Dobson because you listen to WBAI. You should be listening to WOR or something like that. This is conservative, right-wing, Christian conservative writer who sold tens of millions of books. His operation is so big it has its own individual zip code. But we've never heard of him because he's not promoted on WBAI. So we're at the other end of the spectrum. His reaction is that to counter the corrupting and corrosive influence of the contemporary modern family, we have to exert what he defines, he doesn't use these terms, as a strict paternalistic model of family and society, a strict paternalistic authoritarian model of family and society. So he's a believer in congruence theory, and he sees the family as the most important socializing agency. So if we socialize the child in the family to respecting authority and respecting the centrality of a father figure, then we will socialize that child into being a good citizen, because he sees government embodying a strict paternalistic model. And don't underestimate the power of these ideas, because this idea informs the language of the Bush administration. It informs their language. In any case, the most important function of the family, again, is to socialize that child, and this requires strict discipline that emanates from that powerful, authoritarian, paternal figure. So strict discipline. And his Dare to Discipline, that's his best-selling book. I think he sold 16 million copies to date and counting. Do a Google search, James Dobson, and see what you come up with, how many pages you come up with. For a person probably most of you never heard of. In any case, as we said, strict discipline. And there's a unifying logic that it defines the agenda of the Republican right. And that logic is discipline is key to maintaining social order. Discipline is key to maintaining social order. So the unifying logic, this logic defines domestic family. It defines how the Republicans want to legislate for families. So we want legislation that will not punish parents for disciplining their children. We want a social environment that will encourage spanking your children. We want to encourage this. We want people to dare to discipline, because only then will you be able to restore order in your family. It informs domestic policy. So if that's your logic, if your child acts up, what do you have to do? Impose your authority, even if it means through physical force. If members of society act up, what do you have to do? Impose your authority. What sort of policies would that attitude lead to? For domestic law and order, more policing and more prisons. So isn't this what the Republicans advocate? Society is crumbling. And the juvenile delinquents are everything we need. More police, more criminals are everywhere. Crime is proliferating. How do we solve this? More policing and more prisons to straighten them out by imposing authority on them. And in the international system, what sort of policies would that mindset lead to when you have misbehaving nations? A bigger army and a more aggressive interventionist foreign policy that even includes preemptive strikes. Sometimes you have to work here. The big problem with this model, if you're going to fix society, starting at the family, domestically, internationally, but our focus is on the family, and your solution lies in the strict paternal authoritarian model, the having the courage to discipline. What's the problem with that in American society specifically? What's the defining feature of the American family in the year 2005? It's the fathers aren't in the home. There's a book called Fatherless America for a number of reasons. Economic, social, psychological, the fathers aren't in the home. So in reality, this model reinforces one of the greatest dysfunctions of the modern family. And that is a tendency towards the suffocating mother, what's called the suffocating mother. And that in the absence of the father, the mother will become the authority figure, and her effort to assert her authority will be most strongly manifested in her dealing with the males, with the boys. And so you get the suffocating mother. And this is caricatured. How many of you saw at the movie Denzel Washington, Antoine Fisher? His adoptive mother. She was a caricature of the suffocating mother. What did she do? Took him in the basement and tied him up and beat him brutally. So she's going to impose her authority on him. She's going to break his rebellious spirit, even if she kills him. So we get the term loving your children to death. So this model only reinforces that particular dysfunction. And that's his big problem. The second reaction, you have the liberal reaction. So if the conservative reaction can be epitomized by the strict paternalistic authoritarian discipline model, the liberal reaction involves the nurturing family. And that's epitomized by the kibbutz system in Israel in its early days, where in the pursuit of a perfect democracy, the family becomes, the liberal family becomes the nurturing family, a council of equals, where the child has equal rights. And one of the absurdities arising from this is your child's ability to sue you. If you discipline me, I'll sue you. I'll call my lawyer or tell my teacher and she'll get me a lawyer and we'll sue you or we'll have you thrown in jail because we're all equals here. You don't have a right to put your hands on me if I don't want you to. So we have the family as a council of equals. Now, one of the most disastrous consequences of this model is that it separates love from discipline. In other words, the only way a parent as an equal can manifest his or her love for the child is by doing everything the child wants. So I love you, Johnny, so here's more candy. Because I know you like candy. I love you, Aisha, so I'm going to buy you another dress because I know you like a new dress every week. So saying no, you can't have a new dress because I don't want you to become a brainless consumer. That's not a manifestation of love. So any aspect in the relationship that involves authority and discipline is seen as a negation of love. So the extreme version of this model separates love from discipline. And that generates its own dysfunctions. And I'll try very briefly to identify a few. I'm going to have to skip around in my notes in the interest of time. In any case, it's a total failure. This model is a total failure. And It's what was the rationale? We mentioned the rationale for it was to encourage a democratic personality. If we grow up in a democratic family where everyone's equal and everyone participates in decision making and there's no final authority, this will encourage a child that can freely and easily assimilate into a democratic society and participate in a democratic society. But the result was the exact opposite. This situation led to the development of a personality type that was very conducive to totalitarian control for two reasons. One, the fear of being alone. So once you tell a child, we're all equal, basically you're saying, you don't need me, you're on your own, so you figure it out. So you don't want a mama's boy. I don't want you clinging to me. You know, let me put you in this cage, I mean this crib, and teach you how to survive on your own and to deal with isolation and not be so clingy. So the child grows up feeling alone and detached. And there's no firm mechanism in the family to encourage a feeling of attachment. This is one consequence that leads to authoritarianism. Why? Because the child then looks for alternative institutions to provide a sense of belonging. And in the modern situation, there are two, the gang or the nation. And both the gang and the nation demand or provide a totalitarian function, demand total commitment. Total commitment. And this manifests itself in the gang where you can join in, but you have to die out. If you don't do what we say, when we say, how we say, your life is in danger. And it manifests itself in fascism, where the nation becomes the supra family. That everyone, and fascism is the bundle, right? The fasci, the bundle of twigs tied together, and you're just one twig in the bundle. So the nation becomes an institution that provides a sense of meaning, and again, taken to its logical extreme, demands total commitment. So the effort at democratization in reality led to totalitarianism. In conclusion, the Islamic redefinition would involve the best bringing aspects of both of these approaches together. Very briefly, authority mitigated by shura. So in the model presented by Dobson, there's pure authority and there's no shura. But as Muslims, amruhum shura baynahum. Their affairs are based on mutual consultation. Allah Ta'ala beautifully illustrates it in the case of Ibrahim alayhi salam. He's in charge, but despite that, he consults his son. You know, I've seen in the ara fil manam anni azbahuka fanzur madha tara. So I've seen, and that's an order, that I have to sacrifice you. What do you think about this? قَالَ يَا أَبَ تَفْعَلْ مَا تُؤْمَرْ سَتَجِدُنِي إِنْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ مِنَ الصَّابِرِينَ. Father, do what you've been commanded. You will find me, if Allah so wills, amongst those who are patient. So there was a process of consultation here. The Prophet himself, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, فَبِرَحْمَةٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ لِنْتَ لَهُمْ وَلَوْ كُنْتَ فَضًّا غَلِيظَ الْقَلْبِ لَنْفَضُّوا مِنْ حَوْلِكَ. Now, by Allah's mercy, you were gentle in your dealings with them. So he's in charge. He's the ultimate authority. And this is a lesson for us. There has to be authority in our institution, starting in the family. And this goes back to what Brother Mu'izz was saying. But there has to be ihsan. There has to be gentleness. لِنْتَ لَهُمْ. There has to be mercy. فَبِمَا رَحْمَةٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ. There has to be the opposite of fuzuv, lo kunta fadhan, a fadh, if you were coarse and crude. So there has to be the opposite of that in the hearts of the members of the family, in the hearts of the members of the society. Ghaliz al qalb, if there's no compassion. So there has to be compassion to make this system work. Lan faddu min hawlik. They would have fled away from you. They would have scattered. So we see a scattering in our families in many instances because there is no compassion, there is no mercy, there is no gentleness in dealing with each other, or there is no authority. So Allah Ta'ala is not saying all of these wonderful, beautiful characteristics in an environment of anarchy. So fa'afu anhum. So there has to be a spirit of pardon and forgiveness. So overlook their faults. Wastaghfir lahum. And seek their improvement. Seek their forgiveness. Seek their, that Allah Ta'ala, when you make istighfar, you're seeking something from Allah. So not only you forgive them, fa'afu anhum, but seek Allah's forgiveness for them. Wastaghfir lahum. And which indicates something very beautiful and powerful, and that is, at the end of the day, there's only so much you can do. You can pardon them, but at the end of the day, wastaghfir lahum. Seek Allah's help in your dealings with them. Washawirhum fil amr. And consult them in the affair. Now, then the authority is reaffirmed. فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. Then once you've made a decision, so there is an authority in place. And there has to be a final decision. And a final decision maker. In all of our institutions, if they're going to function effectively. But that authority cannot be divorced from the compassion, the mercy, the gentleness and leniency, the softness of heart, and all of those characteristics. And if those are missing, it won't work. And this is what Brother Mu'izz was saying. We can have all the laws in the world, all of the rulings, the ahkam can be there. We can have all the details of creed, that can be there. But if the culture that provides the glue to hold that all together in a coherent fashion is missing, and that's the ihsan. The bird cannot fly without a tail. So the bird can have the wing of sharia and the wing of aqiqah. It can have law and it can have creed. But if it doesn't have a tail, it won't have any stability. And we see a lot of unstable Muslims that know the rulings. That's haram, that's halal, that's bid'ah, that's shirk. They know the rulings. And they know the creed, the superficial manifestations. But there's no stability because the tail is missing. All of those aspects that provide internal stability. So that's one aspect. Authority mitigated by shura. And a nurturing environment, the liberal solution, that's augmented and mitigated by authority. So joining the best of both models, and this is the essence of Islam, which I've hopefully hinted at in some of the latter comments. Now, the challenge for us, in true conclusion, a couple of false alarms there. The challenge for us, as we strive to develop an alternative family for ourselves and others, is to attain to a degree of spiritual depth. Because we're going against the force of history. We're going against at least 200 years of socialization. We're going against 200 years of very, very powerful institutionalization. And it affects us in very deep ways that most of us don't realize. But we are products of our time. And without the help from Allah Ta'ala, it's going to be mission impossible without the help from Allah Ta'ala. Because our resources in and of ourselves, in the face of the forces arranged against us, are scarce and scanty. Our resources are scarce and scanty, but the resources of Allah Ta'ala are unlimited. And if we seek strength to Allah through Allah Ta'ala, and we seek help from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's a doable proposition. So we have to have a deep spiritual strength and a deep relationship with Allah ta'ala. We have to work to cultivate ihsan within ourselves. And finally, we have to realize that we don't need a revolution. Because the defining feature of every revolution in modern times has been what? Huh? Bloodshed, certainly I'm looking for something else. That's right, though. What else? Defining feature of every revolution has been, all right, Crane Britton called it the Thermidor reaction. Has been what? Counter-revolution. Counter-revolution, in which the institutions, the practices that we were trying to do away with only reasserted themselves in a more terrible form. So after almost a century of communism in Russia, what do we get? We get perverted capitalism. We get the mafiaization of the Russian economy. Right? So we get a perverted form of hypercapitalism that is even more unjust than the version the revolution was instituted to do away with in the first place. So we don't need a revolution. And if once we get that in our minds, we can realize we're hopefully planting the seeds that will bring forth the fruits that future generations will reap. Now, understanding that, we go about our business in an entirely different way. We realize it's not so important that we put up this huge tree that has no roots. That's the fruit of the revolution. And soon as a strong wind comes by, over goes the tree. No, we have to plant this seed, and we have to plant it very deeply, and we have to plant it, choose very fertile ground, so that when it does bear fruit, it's going to be firmly rooted, and that fruit will continue to bring benefit generation after generation. That's the point. So we have to understand what we're up against, understand the nature of society, and understand that very little we do will immediately benefit us, possibly. Allah Ta'ala ala kulli shay'in qadir, judging by history and established social laws. Now, that understanding in and of itself takes a lot of ihsan to understand I might not benefit from this, but if I do this effectively, those after me will benefit. So I might have to sacrifice my gratification from the actions I'm undertaking in the interest of benefiting those who will come after me. And if we can understand that, we'll go about our business in a tremendously different way, and hopefully in a very productive way. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For more information on traditional Islam in America, please contact Zaytuna Institute at 510-582-1979 and on the internet at www.zaytuna.org.